gonna get started. Oh, that's fine with me. We are fighting American Revolution in 52 minutes, so it's gonna be really fast, so you all know. The first thing to remember, we're gonna look at this from a perspective of a new perspective, at least slightly new for you guys. There's the traditional viewpoint, the good versus bad. It was the Americans versus the nasty British. It was the patriots who were fighting for liberty and freedom and all that good stuff versus the redcoats who wanted to oppress the Americans. Right now, what we want to do is keep in mind that this was also the first modern struggle of a nation to gain independence, to set up a free national state, to get rid of a colonial power, to get rid of a king, to get rid of arbitrary rule, and for liberation. This is going to be a model for future independence movements that will be carried out throughout Latin America, India, Asia, other places in Asia, other places in Africa. So this is going to be a model. It's a revolution about nationalism, more than it's just good versus bad, more than it's just the Americans versus the British. Of course, we have the early patriotic view. There are certain things that are true about that. The Americans were more familiar with their terrain. They were able to carry out guerrilla warfare, and the British weren't. They weren't used to that. They hadn't used that sound before. European warfare, you line up, you shoot each other, and the next person shoots the next person, and you go on formation. Well, here, we're not doing that anymore. Sorry, this is all part of the introduction, by the way. It's okay, just add it in. This is still about democracy versus monarchy. That view still stands, although not as much democracy as we think. Remember that slaves still couldn't vote. A third of the population or a fifth of the population couldn't vote, even after this, even after we're all independent. So it's not totally as democratic as we had assumed or previously, our more traditional patriotic views. There's more of a perspective on it that this had bigger consequences than just establishing democracy in America. Skip that one. Just make this, we have to go with that. Sorry, guys. Colonial problems. There were a number of problems that the colonies faced. Number of problems. They opposed England. England was, at the time, the most powerful nation, the most powerful imperial power in the world. So these 13 little disunited colonies are opposing the greatest power in the world at this time. That's a big problem. We also have a little problem that one-third of the population supported the British. So even within the colonies, you already know that. One-third supported the British, and only one-third supported the actual cause. The rest of them just kind of picked sides with whoever was in town at that time. If there were a bunch of loyalists around, it was really popular to be a loyalist. There are a bunch of patriots running through. You were pretty patriotic. We had no navy. The United States had, or the Americans, had no navy. We aren't the United States yet. The Americans had no navy. The British had technically the number one navy in the world. There were some issues with their navy, but technically it was the greatest navy in the world. Didn't really matter that much. We end up building up a navy using privateers, which are merchant ships that will be armed and will be more effective than a navy, the British Navy could be. We have no strong army either. The British have 30,000 soldiers at hand. We have a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there, a few people who show up, come out on the weekends. We have militias. We have people who fight and then go back and tend their farms. It's not exactly a highly regulated army, not a well-trained army. We also had no treasuries. We were broke. We couldn't even afford to pay the soldiers that we had. In fact, riots will break out over this. Mutinies will break out over this. People want to be paid. There just isn't money to do it. The government at the time, which wasn't really a government at all, but the Continental Congress, didn't have the power to tax. You can't tax, you can't raise money, you can't pay people. So we'll see big problems arise from that, just in terms of mutinies and riots and people rebelling, but also in terms of people are getting supplies. You can't afford supplies. You can't afford munitions. You can't afford clothes, things that people, food that people need to survive in the, as they're fighting. We have a loose government structure. We don't even have an official government. There was a debate as to whether or not to call together the Continental Congress. We had the first one, and it disbanded, fell apart, and then we get the second Continental Congress. And they're a loose confederation. Nobody's really in charge. Nobody really has the authority to tell anybody else what to do. Everybody's just hoping people will do it. Versus Britain, that is a strong, unified country. Hopefully that's not a surprise to any of you. They have hundreds of years of history behind them. Lots of power, lots of strength, a good system of government structure, is a structure-wise, it's very well structured, with the king as a monarch, and the parliament as the law-passing body, legislative body. They were unified, and they knew who was in charge. They didn't always listen to that guy, but they knew who was in charge. There was this unity among the American states, the colonies and then the states. They didn't have much in common. A farmer from the south was not very much like a New England merchant. So they didn't really trust each other. They didn't really have a desire or need to work together, at least initially. Okay. There's also an element of, an economic element. The Americans were dependent on the British, thanks to mercantilism, for all their finished goods. Americans were dependent on the British for finished goods. We send all of our resources over, we get stuff back. Are the British going to pay, or are going to give us the goods that we need more at a reasonable price? Probably not. We just declared war, essentially. So it's difficult to get the goods that we need. We'll have to start making them ourselves, and that takes time and that takes money. We also had some issues with trust. There were spies everywhere. You couldn't trust anybody, really. There were spies who worked for newspapers. There were spies who worked as school teachers. There were spies who worked in the army. There were spies on both sides, though. So the British faced this as well. In fact, General Gage, who's one of the generals we'll talk about in a little bit, his wife, British general, was a spy for the Americans because she was sympathetic, at least. At least to the cause of the Americans. Benedict Arnold, who I have a picture of for you. Benedict Arnold was the biggest surprise, probably. Benedict Arnold, you've all heard his name before, was a well-respected, prominent,
up-and-coming
official in the army, an officer in the army. He was a hero at Quebec, the Battle of Quebec, and the Battle of
Saratoga,
which was the turning point in the war. He was very well respected, and he had a big ego. He really thought he deserved the respect and really thought he should get a higher post or a higher command because of that. So when it came time to open up some new positions, the head of the leader of the Committee on the Continental Congress appointed
other people, inferiors, people who were younger than him
and less experienced than him, to those posts, gave them the generalships, and Benedict Arnold was angry. He was eventually appointed to command at West Point. He was appointed to command at West Point, but he was still angry because he still had to report to these people who were younger than him and less experienced than him. And so when General Clinton of the British Army offered him about $1 million to give up West Point, he said okay. And they send letters back and forth, and they're communicating about how he's going to give up West Point and he's going to basically be a traitor to the American cause, and those letters are intercepted. So Benedict Arnold sells out West Point, basically, but his messenger isn't very good at getting the message through. So he gets caught, he gets killed, hanged. Benedict Arnold gets, he escapes down the Hudson River, and eventually gets a post in the British military, British Army. But his name will go down in history as a traitor, even though he started out as one of these really respected, up-and-coming, young, prominent leaders of the American military. So it was a big problem. It was a big problem for the Americans. We also had some problems with jealous generals. Charles Lee was a general during the same time Washington, there were several generals. He was an under under George Washington. George Washington was the commander-in-chief, and this guy was under him. And this guy was told to reinforce Washington's army, the Battle of Monmouth. And he says no. He doesn't take his troops. He doesn't reinforce Washington's army. Washington is really struggling. They just don't show up. It kind of leaves Washington hanging out to dry. And the reason he did it was that he thought that it would get the Continental Congress to pull George Washington out of command, and he would get command of the Continental Army. So he did it in order to sort of sabotage Washington so that Lee could get the authority that he was seeking. Instead, it cost him the battle. He won't take orders, he's second in command, he has a place, and he just doesn't do what he's supposed to do. Some other problems that the American armies had. There were many, many fewer soldiers in the American army than there were in the British army. No more than 1,000 regulars. There were militia, people who were called up, who signed up, who came out and fought and then went home. But there were no more than roughly 1,000 people who were career soldiers in the American Continental Army. And as a result, it was instability in the army. These guys would go home for harvest season. They were inexperienced. They got lost. They didn't have the tactical training. They didn't have the training behind them on how to find their way out of problems. They were ill-paid, so they were especially upset because not only were they away from home, they weren't fed, they weren't trained, but now they were being paid what they were supposed to be paid. Most of them had short-term enlistments, only 6 months or so. So it made it difficult to get them trained. There was no continuity. So it made it very difficult to have a well-trained army when you have new people coming in all the time. It makes long campaigns impossible. You can't have a six-month campaign. You can't have a year-long campaign. To defeat the enemy, you got to go in, shoot a bunch of people, and then come out. As quickly as possible. Hopefully, not in retreat. Hopefully, because you want. Food, clothing, weapons, munitions, all those things were in short supply. Food was abundant, but getting it to the soldiers was hard. That was the problem. Clothing and munitions, all those things were produced by the British and came from elsewhere. So it was difficult to get those things. We were very dependent, like I said, on English goods. And from the very beginning, the Americans were hugely outnumbered. Great Britain had 4-1, 4 soldiers to our every 1 in the battle, fighting. So how do we win if all these odds are against us? It's not a good picture for the Americans, and they're definitely the underdogs, and Americans kind of embraced that. But it wasn't just British fortitude and tenacity that was able to bring them out ahead of the British. The British had plenty of problems of their own, so we're going to talk about some of those. Some of them are pretty familiar to you. They were fighting in a hostile environment. They weren't used to the type of fighting. They weren't used to guerrilla warfare. Soldiers in the American army could go home when they got hurt. British soldiers had to hang out with the army and be miserable and die and catch diseases and starve when they got sick, when they got hurt. Disease was a huge problem. The Royal Navy had 18,000 deaths due to disease. 18,000 deaths due to disease versus 1,200 from actual fighting, from bullets or from getting bayoneted. So disease took far more lives on both sides, really, but the British had a really big problem with it. There was also a big problem with mutinies and desertions. Mutinies and desertions. People just leaving. They're tired of fighting. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have what they need. They have bad leaders. They're walking around in circles. They're starving. They're cold. They want to go home, so they do. U.S. soldiers were also in better physical condition. These British soldiers were used to marching around with guns and intimidating people and scaring people. But the Americans were used to running around on farms and across fields and after animals and hunting, so they were in better physical condition to be fighting a war, especially in the rugged terrain that they were fighting. There was also a lot of area. A lot of area. The U.S. is 20 times the size of Great Britain. 20 times the size of Great Britain. So there were a lot of places Americans could go hide. And the British couldn't go after them. Didn't know their way around, didn't know where they went. In Great Britain, you only need a small army to keep track of that, a certain number of people. Here, it seemed like you could have almost a limitless army to keep track of it. The Continental Army easily fitted in as well. Easily fit in. To the surroundings, to everybody, to where they were. They could absorb into society very, very easily. The British are walking around in bright red jackets. They don't absorb into society quite as well. The American strategy, one of the strategies, was to draw out the war as long as possible. To draw it out, it's difficult for the Americans, and it's difficult for the British. It makes it difficult to fight. They're tired, they want to go home. And this style of war kept the British involved for long enough that they were finally willing to give up towards the end. Again, they fought this guerrilla style, and General Thomas Gage, a British general, said there was not a stone wall or house, though before in appearance evacuated, from whence the rebels did not fire upon us. Meaning, we looked, and there was nobody there, and all of a sudden there's bullets flying at us. Where are they coming from? These are Americans who are very good at hiding, very sneaky, they're behind fences, they're up trees, they're under eaves on roofs, they're hiding in attics all over the place, shooting at the British, and the British have no way of defending against it. They're not used to it, they don't know what to do about it. Makes it very, very difficult. But it was very, very effective, this style of warfare. The British also had a problem with their generals. Most of them were inept. They were useless. They were old. They weren't used to this new way of fighting. Many of them were lazy. They didn't want to go out in the cold. General Clinton, had 20,000 men. Washington only had 7,000 at Valley Forge. He could have easily overtaken him, and he didn't because it was too cold. He didn't want to go out. He didn't pursue Washington. Nobility also filled the army and the navy. Most people bought their commissions. Many officers bought their commissions, or they got them handed down from them, from parents or fathers or whoever it was. They didn't really want to be in the army. They didn't want to fight, but they wanted some sort of title or notoriety. They were officers in the army. And they weren't good at it. They weren't any good at it. They didn't know what they were doing. General Howe, who was also a British general, had many opportunities, especially early on, to capture Washington, but because he was lazy and slow to react, not willing to go on the offensive at that point, he never captured Washington. So the war dragged out and really cost the British. He was described as too worried about losing to actually worry about winning. So he didn't ever went on the offensive. The British army was poorly led. They all had strategies. They didn't show up when they were supposed to. They made their own decisions and split up. Generals split up and did things that they weren't supposed to. Battle of Yorktown wasn't even supposed to happen. They weren't even supposed to be in Virginia, and they were, and that's what ended the war finally, which we'll get to. Again, the unknown terrain, the British population was split. Many people were at least sympathetic to the American cause. I'm sorry, at least apathetic to the American cause. So they didn't care either way. They didn't support the war. They didn't support the British. But they definitely didn't oppose the Americans, and that causes some problems for the British. The British fleet was spread too thinly. The British is all over. They're defending against the French in the West Indies. They're dealing with the colonies in New England and the middle colonies in the South. They're in Australia. They're in Canada. They're all over the place. They're spread very thinly, and it becomes a big problem. It becomes very difficult to handle the war. It kind of goes out of control and stretches them too thinly. To the point that Parliament is eventually going to be willing to try to negotiate. By the time they finally come around and realize they're not going to win, the Americans realize they are, and so they're unwilling to negotiate and just go for final victory, ultimate victory, and get it. They achieve it. Okay. Here's talking about the early war. And the first battle we're going to talk about is Lexington and Concord. We've already mentioned Lexington and Concord.
I've heard about them. Early battles before the Declaration
of Independence is signed. The Declaration of Independence has
not been signed.
In April 1775, the British, doing what they have done many times before, they get word that there's munitions and leaders of the Continental Army or the Continental Congress
in
Lexington and Concord, and they're going to go and confiscate the munitions. They're not supposed to have them there. They've already confiscated munitions in Charleston and Cambridge, Massachusetts, so they're just going to keep going up to Lexington. Well, this occurs 14 months before the Declaration of Independence, and word gets to the Americans. As the British are leaving Boston Common, marching down the road to Lexington, people are going ahead of them on their way to Lexington to warn Samuel Adams and John Hancock, who are in Lexington, two leaders, revolutionary leaders. You guys should be familiar with those guys. They go there to warn them. They're going to be captured. If they're there when the British get there, they're going to be captured. So they're standing around trying to figure out what to do. Paul Revere and Sam Prescott and William Dawes and some of the other people who have gone down in history as the Midnight Riders go and warn the people in Lexington, tell John Hancock and Samuel Adams to get out of there, and wake up the countryside and say the regulars are out. The regulars in the army, the British, are coming, and they're coming for us. So that gives them time to organize. There's a skirmish. They're fighting in the countryside again. This guerrilla-style warfare. British aren't totally prepared for it. Eight Americans are killed.
10 are wounded at
Lexington. And one British is killed. One British soldier is wounded. Sorry. There were 700 British soldiers who were sent, which is actually a lot for this kind of job. So as Samuel Adams is leaving, he realizes what's happening. John Hancock is standing there with him. Samuel Adams says, "What a glorious morning this is." And John Hancock looks at him and says, "What do you mean? This is not glorious. People are
dying."
And he says, "I mean for America." So John Hancock, Samuel Adams, knows what this means. It's the first bloodshed. They move on to Concord. This is a little bit more aggressive. Lexington was kind of an accident. Nobody's really sure who fired the first shot. They just start firing, and things get bad. Concord was a bigger fight. The
British begin to lose. They're not
ready for the guerrilla warfare. So they start their retreat back to Boston. They retreat back to Boston with the colonists shooting at them the whole way. And in fact, the British sent reinforcements from Boston to meet these guys on the road because they're losing guys. This whole incident, Lexington and Concord,
is what Ralph Waldo Emerson
would later call the shot heard around the world. So really, this became an international event. This is the first time that the colonists are fighting against Britain. The first time a colony is rebelling against its imperial power, the colonizer. And so it makes it a worldwide event. After these events, the British still don't think the Americans are going to revolt. They just think this is sort of over the boiling point kind of thing. The Americans don't
really think they're going to revolt
yet. They're not
at that point yet. But this gives the Americans a little bit of
power. This gives them a little bit of a morale boost. They see that they can beat the British. They see that they do have a chance at this. It was one in a series of events that leads up to the revolution, and it's just one of those things that continues to build on the stress and the tension between the two countries, between the Americans and the British. Then we get the Battle of Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill is a hill in Boston, and it's not a big hill, but it's a hill. And hills are good for wars. If you are in control of them, you can look down and shoot people, and you can see who's coming. And so strategically, it's important. So the British want it. The Americans have it. The Americans are
stationed
or posted up on top of the hill. They see the British coming. They start firing at them.
And they
mow down a few of them, I guess. Shoot some British soldiers as they're coming up the hill. The Americans lose the hill. But they still killed a few British soldiers. They killed how many? They technically lost, but they killed 1,000 British soldiers in the process. We lost 400. The British lost 40% of their soldiers who were there. 1,000 soldiers. This gives America confidence. This gives them a morale. We can fight. We can do this. We can beat the British. We may not have won this battle, but this is just one step towards building up more morale. It gives them the confidence to write and to sign the Declaration of Independence, show the possibility of winning. So after Bunker Hill, the Americans get together and convene the Second Continental Congress. John Adams is instrumental in the Second Continental Congress, really promotes the idea of independence, but not so far as writing the Declaration of Independence. Thinks it's really important. They're not really sure that they're there yet. They're going to send one document first. Beginning in May 1775, they start working on something called the Olive Branch Petition. The Olive Branch Petition. One last attempt. They implore the King of England, please, please, King George III, please procure us some relief from Parliament. Make Parliament stop doing what it's doing. And we won't fight. We won't rebel. We won't revolt. They say, we're loyal to you. We have respect for you. We have an attachment to your majesty's person, family, government, etc., etc. Please make the Parliament stop. The king refuses to receive the message. Won't accept the petition. Rebuffs the Americans. Unimportant to him. So now the Americans realize that the king's not going to do anything to make Parliament stop. Parliament isn't going to do anything to stop. In fact, they would rather do worse things. So we will move on to the Declaration of Independence. We're not at Declaration of Independence. We're going to move on to common sense. The Americans are rebuffed. Their request, their petition, their olive branch, their peace offering is rebuffed. So they're fired up. Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense, he was a fairly unsuccessful Englishman who came over to America to start his life over. He'd been a corset maker and a tax collector, and I think he'd been a really bad farmer. All these things. His life was terrible in England, so he comes to America. Along the way somewhere, he builds up a good reputation with Benjamin Franklin, though. Benjamin Franklin meets him in England, writes him a letter of recommendation. He gets a job when he gets to America as a journalist in a newspaper. And he gets pretty well known as a journalist, eloquent writer, very good writer. And he's chosen to write down what a lot of people aren't willing to say or do yet. He writes Common Sense, where he challenges or questions the King of England, calls him a tyrant, puts forth the idea of independence in the public and for everybody to hear. He questions how a small island can rule a big country. Doesn't make sense. How a little island in the North Atlantic can rule a country. He encourages the colonists to reject arbitrary power. Encourages the colonists to reject arbitrary power and to form a republican government. And he turns the American cause into an international event. Brings the American cause into an international base. He says it was a revolution for the world, for history, and for the future. It was excellent, excellent propaganda. Americans ate it up. People around the world ate it up. In 3 months, 120,000 copies of this little pamphlet were sold. And over the course of the revolution, 6 or so years, 500,000 were distributed. That's a lot. That is a lot. Excellent propaganda, again, like I said, it inspired Americans, the general public, the people of America, to this idea of independence. It didn't make sense that a lion could control us. It didn't make sense that this guy should have arbitrary power over us. And so it really encouraged and took another step forward, and there's common sense for you, to the Declaration of Independence, and that's where we are right now. This is a document that's going to unify everybody, and we're in the Revolution. It's going to put everybody together on the same page. Thomas Jefferson is chosen as a member of a committee, but he's the principal writer, to write this document. He's not reinventing the wheel here. He isn't starting from scratch. He pulls from all sorts of sources, very legitimate sources, from state constitutions, from charters, from probably even some stuff from the Magna Carta, way back then. He pulls all these old things and puts them together in this document. His purpose is to justify to the world why America is revolting, why breaking ties with the English. His purpose is to justify to the world why the U.S. is severing ties with the English. He wanted a document that would appeal to everybody. These are age-old, understood principles. He includes 27 things that we don't like about British rule. He states the philosophies behind rejecting those, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, or property, or whatever it is. And he asserts independence for the Americans. So 27 grievances, the philosophies behind rejecting all of these things that the British are doing, and then the assertion that we will be an independent nation. We will be an independent nation of states. On July 2nd, the resolution comes to the committee, goes to the rest of the delegates for the rest of the Congress for approval. They don't approve it because in it, there's a provision that blames slavery on King George and essentially outlaws it. And Southern planters, who are totally dependent on slavery, refuse to approve the document while it outlaws slavery. So slavery will not be included in the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution will have an expiration date for slavery, but the Declaration of Independence maintains slavery in the states. And after that, it's approved. So July 4th, the committee agrees the Declaration of Independence is passed, so that's our Independence Day. And we are officially a new country. We are officially a new country. Now that's important for several reasons. First, because now it's not people of the same country fighting each other, now it's people of two different countries fighting each other. It's a war between two nations, so that means that we no longer are traitors. Americans are no longer traitors. They are now POWs if they're captured. You have to treat prisoners of war differently than you have to treat traitors. So that was an important thing for the Americans to establish. Other than the morale that it created in our own nation and being independent, was also for logistical reasons a good thing. And there's the Founding Fathers in the Hall in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, signing the Declaration of Independence. Battle of Long Island. We're going to go through some of the big battles, some of the important ones. Don't believe you have to know any other than the ones that are listed here. Not probably check with your teachers on that. New York was important. New York was an important place for the British to control because it provided major access to the interior of the Americas, or North America, of the states. The British leave the colonies, head up to Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia, regroup, and they're going to start an attack from the north. They're sending more soldiers over to Nova Scotia, they're sending more soldiers up to Canada, and they're going to march down. In August 1776, 32,000 British soldiers land in New York. 32,000 British soldiers land in New York. The goal is to control the harbor, the New York Harbor, major access for shipping and for trade, and to control the Hudson River, which provides access to the interior, provides access to the middle colonies and the interior colonies and out to the west. The first battle in New York and New Jersey aimed at gaining control of the middle states and separating New England from the south. They wanted to cut New England off from the southern colonies. At that point, General Howe really could have done it. He really could have crushed the Americans at New York, but he doesn't do it. He hesitates, which was typical of his generalship. The British, the Americans are able to retreat, so they aren't able to be, they aren't defeated. But the 21,000 or so British soldiers who were in Long Island overwhelmed the Americans. There were only about 3,000 Americans in Long Island. So they first retreat to Manhattan. The Americans first retreat to Manhattan, which is an island, and then cross the whatever river that is, the East River, perhaps? West? I don't know. And go into New Jersey. So they finally retreat to New Jersey. It was very evident at this point that General Washington was inexperienced. He made a couple tactical errors. He allowed the British to draw him where they wanted him to be and then force them to retreat. So they give up New York. The Americans give up New York, and the British will hold it for the rest of the war. So they have major shipping and trading ports that are available only to them, which is going to cause problems for supplying Americans. It's going to be used as a base of operations for the rest of the war for the British. And it's also an area that's going to be full of loyalists, so mainly a loyalist group in New York City, in all of New York, Long Island. So that was a critical strategic victory for them. With the fighting so close to Philadelphia, the Continental Congress flees from Philadelphia and ends up going up farther north, I think, into Pennsylvania. So they actually have to leave and abandon the seat of the government because the fighting is so close. The battles of Trenton and Princeton. This is December 26th, and then sophomores. January 3rd. This is Christmas 17th. Is he here? Whatever. Let's see, where were we? Okay, this is the famous Washington crossing the Delaware. He takes his troops into Trenton, crosses the Delaware River. It was a miserable cold night, very, very cold. The river partially freezes over. The rain comes, it melts it. There's icebergs and stuff floating around the river. The Americans are cold, but they're dedicated. The German Hessians who are stationed at Trenton are not so dedicated. It's Christmas, they celebrate. They drink a little too much, eat, drink, and be merry. And they're hungover or whatever it is the next day and are completely surprised by the Americans showing up on the doorstep. So the Americans capture 900 German Hessians in Trenton, captured 900 German Hessians, killed or wounded 106 of them, and only lost 0-4. There's some debate about how many Americans were actually killed. So somewhere between 0 and 4. Two of which probably died from freezing to death, not from anything related to the battle. That tells you how cold it was. Princeton, there was another small victory, not a big one, but again, good for morale. They capture more Hessians. Those are the paid mercenary soldiers, remember. Both victories, the importance of them is that they gave Americans hope. Americans really felt like they'd be able to win. It builds up Washington's image, boosts morale, helps to the French who are keeping an eye on this war, helps to build up support by the French and other nations, and foreign aid begins to arrive as a result of this. Foreign aid begins to arrive from France and from Spain, who both don't like the British very much and will take whatever they can get, as long as the British don't, or they'll support whoever they can against the British. So Trenton and Princeton, not huge battles, but significant because of the support and the morale boost that they get from them. The Battle of Saratoga is far more important. It's considered the turning point, one of the most important battles of the war. It was not run by Washington. Washington was not in charge at Saratoga. It was General Horatio Gates, not Gage, who is the British general, but Gates, who is the American general. And what happened? The British were planning a three-pronged attack. Saratoga is in New York, and there was an army that was going to come down from the north, there was an army that was going to come down from the south, come up from the south, and there was an army that was going to push them out from the west. General Burgoyne, who was a stuffy, older, lazy British general, who had been a very good general but really had kind of lost his touch recently, was going to come from the north. Colonel Leger would come from the west, and then they would meet General Howe, who was advancing from the south, southern near enough, southern New York, not very far south, but still south. Unfortunately, General Howe, who's coming in from New York City, so and the southern, bringing the armies up from the south, decided not to go. He decided not to show up in the Hudson Valley. So they never got their southern reinforcements. He changed his mind and went off to capture Philadelphia. So the northern prong's coming down, the people are coming from the west, the British are coming from the west. General Howe, instead of going north, goes east to Philadelphia. He thought it would break the morale of the colonists. He thought it would be really beneficial to the British if the Continental Congress was captured, which of course didn't happen. They never made it. It took too long, and Washington was able to prepare for it. And even though, in the end, the Americans are not victorious at Philadelphia, they lose Philadelphia, but the Continental Congress won't be captured. The Americans were caught by surprise, and they have to flee. They fight out in two things going on. Philadelphia, they're pestering the British soldiers who are there. Burgoyne is in the Hudson Valley. There's two battles going on at Saratoga at the same time, so we have the two prongs split off. And the battles at Saratoga, there are two. The first is Freeman's Farm, and the second is Bemis Heights. Those two battles at Saratoga are in the middle of an open field. And the British really think that this is their opportunity to shine. They're used to this. You show up in a field, you line up in formation, you start shooting at each other, the next guy shoots, and it'll work out for them. So this battle occurs in Saratoga, and the British are forced to surrender. The Americans lose Philadelphia, though. So Howe's troops that went to Philadelphia win there, but the British lose in Saratoga. So two separate things going on. Saratoga is the turning point because the British lose. They surrender. Burgoyne surrenders his army there. Why is this important? Why is it considered the turning point? First, because the Americans capture the whole British army that's there. They capture everybody. Burgoyne surrenders his army. He doesn't say, we retreat, we're taken off. He gives them up. This also means that the French are now really willing to support the Americans. So this battle brings the French into the war. They know that the Americans now have a chance to win. So they're going to support the Americans. So they want to form a formal alliance with the Americans. There were very, very, very generous surrender terms. So even though Burgoyne surrendered his army, we let them all go back to England. Preventing some ill will. But we had still won, and the French are still going to support us. Oh, there you go. We're going to skip the map. You can look it up in your book. We'll go back. Okay. Valley Forge. What was going on there? This is the winter of 1777 and 78. This is a rough winter for the Americans. We come off of Saratoga. Things are good. Then we have French support. Then we have Valley Forge. We have Brandywine. We have Germantown battles that we are not going to do so well in. We lose all three, technically. Washington gets stuck at Valley Forge in Pennsylvania. And the British Army is living in luxury just a few miles away. The Americans are cold. They don't have supplies. They're not in a great position, so they're really exposed to the elements. So that makes it even worse. The Continental money that we had been using was worthless. It didn't have any value anymore. So it's very difficult to get goods to sell to the army, for the army to buy. 1,000 soldiers deserted during this winter. 3,000 died of malnutrition, exposure, and disease. And it was a real low point for the Continental Army because so many people were dying and so many people were unhappy. The only good thing that comes out of this winter was the former Prussian military officer, former Prussian Baron von Steuben, you've probably read about, organized intense drilling. It really helped to train this army. So when they came out of the winter, even though they were miserable and dying, they were much better prepared to fight. So this is Baron von Steuben. And that helps keep spirits up, even though a lot of people were dying all around them. Got them into shape and really set them on the right foot forward. Out of Valley Forge.
There were a few local victories in New York, but for the most part, Valley Forge was a miserable time. Brandywine, and again, Germantown, not good either. So we end up in a stalemate between 1778 and 1780. There were no major victories or defeats on either side. We're just kind of going on. People retreat, people fight, people go through the motions of war. Few defeats for the Americans in South Carolina, Georgia, farther south. The Americans are retreating, the British are chasing, they're going back and forth, they're taking over land. This is also when Benedict Arnold becomes a traitor in 1780. Maybe he was bored, I don't know, wanted to start something, but he gives up West Point to Clinton at that point. We have huge shortages in U.S. supplies, American supplies, a lack of authority in Congress, currency is worthless. It looks like we're going to lose. It's not good. It's a stalemate, but we're on the losing end of the stalemate, if that's possible. So things are not looking good for us. On the home front, civilians suffer along with the soldiers. They're not getting the supplies that they need, although life for the soldiers is worse. Civilians are suffering less, actually. Most of the fighting is not going on right in towns. Most Americans were self-sustaining farmers, so they had plenty of food. So that wasn't too big of a problem for them. Where you did see an impact was where they were fighting battles in New England, in cities, in towns, but urban fighting caused more of a problem. When England takes over New York, that's going to cut off trade, so merchants are going to be affected by it. Merchants will be affected more by the war. There are some people who live very, very well, some people who live very, very poorly, and it's just the way it is. People who had money could get what they needed from smugglers, and so that was going on quite a bit. We'll see the development of a nouveau riche, these people in the new rich who are able to sell things to the Americans for more money than they're worth because they're in demand, getting stuff from smugglers and able to sell it. Shipping was ruined, though. This was as much a naval war as anything, and it makes it very difficult to trade things. So the economy did struggle a bit. Between 1776 and 1779, there were 570 ships captured off the east coast of the United States today. All right, but we get help. Things are bleak, 1780, but the French finally agree to help. In November 1775, the colonists establish a committee of secret correspondence. And this will eventually be the Committee of Foreign Affairs. Secret correspondence, foreign affairs. They work towards gaining intelligence and forming alliances with nations who will help them out. That's the ultimate goal of this Committee of Foreign Affairs or Committee of Secret Correspondence. They send a guy named Silas Deane as a commercial agent. They always did this. They set up fake corporations and send people over as agents of these businesses to go and get information, to go and negotiate. It looks very innocuous, but really they're trying to get financial aid and military aid from the French. So Silas Deane in March 1776 goes over. Benjamin Franklin goes over. There's Ben meeting with the French court. Benjamin Harrison, Thomas Johnson, all these revolutionaries, all these founding fathers go over and try to negotiate and get French support. France secretly sends us supplies, sends envoys of supplies, secretly sends us supplies after meeting with envoys. Envoys are people, ambassadors who go there and request these things and then they send them back. But that could lead them into the war if they get caught, so they have to be very careful about it. They build up diplomacy. 2 months before the declaration, French decides to aid the United States, but they have to do it all secretly. They allowed American privateers to operate out of French ports, and these are legal pirates. These are people who turn their ships into military ships and seize other British ships and the people on them and the goods on them, and really disrupt trading and cause problems for the British Navy and supply lines and all of that. So the French allow the American privateers to use their ports. The French also, like Ben Franklin, he's an American, obviously you know that. He's the most popular American in France, and he would be called for Marie Antoinette. She would call us our good Americans. We were her friends. He was an ambassador. He made a good name for us in France. This helps build up the diplomacy. He was instrumental in that. The French don't want to join us, though, until they think that we can win. So they don't actually form an alliance with us. They'll help us, but not until Saratoga does it look like we'll actually win. The alliance brought them into as allies with us. They fought with us. They supplied us with partially supplied our navies, gave us supplies. When the war was over, they didn't sign a separate peace agreement with England, but they did guarantee French possession of lands like in America. So they got something out of the war, and they were able to control the West Indies as a result. The war was devastating for the French, though. Plunged the British monarchy, the crown into bankruptcy, and would eventually lead to their own revolution in the following years. Let's see. Other European nations helped us as well. The Spanish provided us with shoes and blankets and socks and all sorts of supplies. Sorry, we're not there yet. The French sent us 5,500 troops to help in Yorktown and a fleet to help with the navy that General de Graaf was able to help defeat the British Navy in the off the coast. We got thousands of soldiers. We got able officers. Remember that Lafayette came to help lead the charge, to help train people. We got money. We had a fleet to replace the navy that we didn't have. And it was a psychological boost that helped train soldiers. All in all, we got $5 million, or about $5 billion of today's dollars, from the French. We got $1.2 million from the Dutch, and we got $200,000 from the Spanish. It wasn't because they liked us. It wasn't because they liked democracy. It's because they didn't like the British that they helped us. We benefited from it, but it wasn't out of the kindness and the goodness of their hearts, necessarily. We'll move to the war on the frontier. We're talking about Ohio Territory, we're talking about Illinois, Indiana, out west in the old Northwest Territory. Great Lakes region is where we're talking. There's not a lot going on. There are Native Americans who are fighting on the side of the British. The British are losing, so the Native Americans are losing. It keeps the Native Americans busy, and so they're not attacking us, they're not attacking Americans independently in the frontier. They were defeated, the Native American armies that were led by loyalists were defeated most of the time. And it was mostly insignificant, the battles that occurred out there, but the outcome of that was important. What it did for us when we beat the British in the frontier was make sure that we established land claims in the West on the frontier. So we get all this land. Remember how much we hated the Proclamation of 1763. The founding fathers were the guys who wanted to go out there and buy land. And they hated the Proclamation of 1763 that said that they couldn't. So this really throws that out the window, gives them the opportunity to claim land. It gives them more freedom, more power, more autonomy from the British. The Sea War. The British Navy was effective, but it was crumbling. It was allowed to crumble. It had been the most powerful war up until about Navy until about 1774 to 1780. The Earl of Sandwich, who was essentially the Secretary of Navy, allowed it to fall apart. He wasn't taking care of the Navy. So it wasn't quite as strong as everybody thinks it was. By the end of the war, the American Navy, made up of the privateers and the French ships and the American ships that we had, was more effective. But at the beginning, they didn't really have much to show for it. The states had navies. 11 of the 13 states had navies, but there wasn't a united American colony, continental navy. So they converted a lot of these ships, these merchant ships, the privateers, converted a lot of their ships into warships. They captured over 600 British merchant ships, and that hits them in the pocketbook. That makes them pay. They lose all the goods, they lose all the crews, they lose the ship. And that's going to be a big problem for them. The American privateers are probably the most important because they get money for the war. They're the ones who are bringing in all the stuff that's going to get them money. And so the Navy, the British Navy was defeated by the privateers by 1780. The British Navy is done. No decisive naval battles, but it was good at disrupting commerce, which sort of crippled the British efforts in the war. Okay, British victories in the South. Most of the big battles tended to be up in the north, New York, Philadelphia, Massachusetts, up further north. There was one major battle, a few major battles in Savannah, Charleston, and Augusta, down in Georgia, and the Carolinas, but not a lot going on. Great Britain had taken most of those cities, though, in the south. Great Britain had taken most of the cities. Then we come to our final battle, and we may run out of time. I think you can still answer your question, so go ahead and answer your question, and your teachers will finish up at the very end of it tomorrow in class. Yorktown was the finale. Yorktown in 1781. There are 9,000 Americans and 7,800 Frenchmen who are there to fight the British. General Lord Cornwallis, or Lord Cornwallis, had retreated. He's about 300 miles off. He had about 8,000 troops that he was able to put together. Washington marches 500 miles southward and surprises them. Long story short, the Americans win, the British surrender. You'll get all the details tomorrow. We signed the Treaty of Paris in 1783, and then that's it. Okay? Answer your questions, your teachers will